First one is about the peculiar behavior in Sodom and Gomorrah. What kind was it? Well, you can just imagine all the things that people do today in pubs and clubs and so on, and add a little bit of cuddling on the way home to it. Throw in a few animals and raise to the nth degree, and that covers it. That's the end of the first question. I've been a little bit of it even in the Isle of Man about 5 years ago. A little bit of that behaviour broke out, probably as an antidote to the excess of Methodism. Special efforts are required at certain moments when attempting work against inertia, sleep, etc. Would you enlarge on the nature of these efforts and comment on the suggestion that such endeavours are stupid and endanger the vehicle of experience? Apparently somebody has said that endeavours, special efforts, are stupid and dangerous and endanger the vehicle of experience. And of course they may. I'll deal very quickly with that one, I think. When we're talking about special efforts, we are talking about efforts in special directions. We don't make a special effort in a general direction, but in a special direction. If you try to work against inertia, you can't work against inertia in general. You have to work against particular inertias. This is why special efforts are needed. You might have a given inertia, it doesn't matter how tiny it is. If you do work against it, you will not endanger the vehicle of experience. If you merely try to overcome inertias, supposing, for instance, you have a cup of coffee or something in the morning at 11 o'clock, and you've always had it, or at least for a sufficient number of years, for there to be a very strong inertic tendency to have it. If you actually break that thing, you have gained a victory over the mechanism in your body. And it is very valuable to be able to do that. Because if you can't break a little thing like that, you will not break bigger things of much more moment. So, we say that it is not stupid or dangerous to the vehicle of experience to break inertias of that kind. And special efforts can only refer to special problems, not to general ones. You cannot make a special effort to go somewhere in general without stating where it is or what it is. Why is it said that sleep is the biggest enemy of yoga? Can this also apply to the work we should be doing? Sleep is the biggest enemy of yoga. Here we have to be very careful that we don't mean by sleep simply going to bed and closing the eyes. Sleep means becoming unaware of what is going on in a given situation, even when you're awake, so-called. If your eyes are open, your ears are accepting sounds, and there is some mode of interpretation of those sounds and visions going on, it does not mean that you are awake. Because interpretation can go on quite mechanically. And most interpretation is of this order. Something is said, and immediately the mind begins to move into phase with it, and you hear comments in your mind about it. But all these comments will tend to be mechanical. And when they are mechanical, you are then asleep. So if we consider sleep to be a special kind of process here, when the spirit, funny kind of leap it's making, isn't it? This L function here means to tie. Remember that L is the link factor and P is any point, whatever. Now you notice this seep function, this seeping. If you imagine that what is seeping here is energy in your organism, and then tie it up so that the seeping process is going on continuously, so that instead of each point being separated and seen clearly, the points tend to merge together. And this merging together is the L function, which causes this seeking process where the spirit, instead of being controlled, is actually seeping into positive situations, and then the whole thing merging together to the point of loss of discrimination. Now, discrimination means seeing things separately. The space between the duality, the creator is the same as the kra function, the creation, and kri means to create, and the moon means to count. So when you're discriminating, you are counting the separate centers within sleep. This process disappears, and there's a general merging of the elements in consciousness together until you cannot adequately discriminate from them. It doesn't look as if it's very important if we get two points like two billiard ball rotations if they were to merge together, because they'd merge into one billiard ball and you'd still know the same form content that you did before. But supposing one of the elements is a triangle and the other one is a circle, and these two begin to seep together, and you then get a form, something like a triangle and something like a circle. This actually happens in the mind under certain conditions, and when it does, then you are fused together in the elements. There's a very interesting little experiment done with animals in this field that's instructive, where thrust onto a screen is a circle, and on a plate on the floor is put nothing. And then there is flashed onto the screen a straight line, and on the plate is put a bone. Now, when the straight line appears on the screen and the bone on the plate, the dog, smelling the bone, ties together the smell of the bone and the visual image in the straight line. Now, after you condition the dog so that every time it sees a straight line, it expects a bone on the plate and goes to it, and you have given it a circle and an empty plate, so that circle now means empty plate, and straight line means bone on plate, then you start making the situation ambiguous in exactly the same way I did with this spherical triangle, a compound of a straight line triangle and a circle. They tested all the well-known breeds of dog with this experiment and noted their innate tendencies in responding to this sort of stimulus, and discovered that all the different breeds had different degrees of tendency to hysteria when the situation became ambiguous. How are we going now? Now, they began then to change the form of the circle by flattening it. Now, when it was a circle, it meant empty plate. When it became progressively more elliptical, then most of the dogs began to be worried. They weren't sure about it. When the thing became very, very narrowly elliptical, something of the echo of the straight line began to appear, and some of the dogs went to the plate to see if there was something on it. Now, some of them exhibited quite hysterical behavior and started screaming, the collie being one of them. One of the dogs, the British Bulldog, as we should have expected, when it was presented with a perfect circle, turned its back on the plate and looked over its shoulder and watched it. As it became progressively more elliptical, it didn't move, and when it was nearly straight, it looked at that one ear. But it didn't move, and then finally, when the thing became straight, it got up, walked across, and got the bone. Now, on the elliptical one, the collie started screaming and rushing about backwards and forwards to and from the plate. Now, this illustration with the animal shows the kind of thing that goes on in the human mind in the case we've illustrated. If we do not discriminate clearly between different forms, there arises a hybrid form, and the result is confusion. And we've said before that every idea has a feeling tone. We like it or we don't like it. from ancestral and individual experience. Supposing we don't like triangle and we do like circle, and then we're presented with a form of a spherical lined triangle, we do and do not like it simultaneously. Now, if we're very phlegmatic about it, we just shake our head. But if we're at all delicately balanced, we start screwing the place down, like the collar did, because it has to go and not go towards the same thing. This ambiguous kind of reaction is what is meant by confusion. The name Babel means the same thing, because the two B's in Babel are tied together by the L and signify that the being itself is divided into two beings, and the two halves of the being are tied together so that one half is moving towards and the other half moving away from the same situation. And this is confusion. The elements fuse together which should be kept separate. Now, if we are presented with a situation of pure triangularity, and we can see that it is a situation of pure triangularity, we are then in possession of a mind non-adulterated. It is seeing the extant fact pure triangle. But if at the same moment a memory of a circle comes and superimposes itself on the triangle, the triangle has been adulterated by the circle. And the energies of the circle start pulling the triangle and bend it, and we get this ambiguous situation. When this happens, the person is asleep to the extant physical situation. He's not awake. He's not seeing the situation exactly as it is. And it is this seeping here of the energy, in this case illustrated as spreading from the circle onto the triangle and bending its sides, and is meant by sleep. Sleep does not mean what people think they mean when they say unconsciousness. Unconsciousness is a very special term. We've used it before. It means the consciousness of the una, and the una is the original hair or scattering energy of the absolute. To be unconscious is to be conscious of a kind of undulating force which does not circumscribe. Now, as soon as you circumscribe, that's no longer unconscious, but unconscious. You see this same thing in the unu concept, a power moving, and the om concept, which is a circumscribing motion. And the om means serpent with tail in mouth, and the un means running serpent. In On Hermopolis, Babel On, you have this center of worship of reflexive self-consciousness, or the being feeding itself, biting its own tail. So we can easily see why sleep is the biggest obstacle to yoga if we define sleep in this way. Sleep does not simply mean going to bed and forgetting who you are. It means that at any given moment, some form from other than the state or situation that you are supposed to be examining comes in and imposes itself and distorts that situation. And we've said this before, we'll repeat it again, that we have broadly two environments. We have a mnemic environment in the mind, in the memory, and the extant physical environment. We'll do a simple illustration. Here is a man, and he sees an object. Light hits the object, bounces in the eye, starts a motion of a nerve, goes to the ocular center, and registers an image there. Now, the first time an object is presented, that object is not known. It is not recognized, because recognition means that you have seen it before and are placing this new form over against one already cognized. Recognized means you make a little cog, you fit that in with an existing pattern. Now, when we see what it is, like a child sees for the first time, it cannot say what's this? It's a pre-logical experience. A child has it when it looks at the moon. It doesn't know the moon is too far to touch. It doesn't know the moon is any farther than that lamp up there. It will need body movement to convince it that the one is too far to walk to and the other one not. In the forebrain here, we have an intellectual center which has in it rational statements about certain forms, and allied to it, the memories are tied in such a way that when a stimulus from outside comes in, the message is sent, and then in that center, a statement is made about this percept. Now, when the statement is made that purely this is a straight line figure with right angles and corners, if it goes back to that center and you then focus back on the object, you can say what it is. But in order to say it, you must have a concept of straight lines, of right angles and so on, which means you're using a logical center. Now you have a center full of the empirically derived messages from your eye, containing all different kinds of shapes, squares, oblongs, triangles, circles, and so on. Now, according to the law of resonance, or even the formal coverage, if a square is presented here, it comes forward, the memory resonates with it, and starts playing all the straight line forms you've ever seen. Now, if you are not careful, these memory forms here will flash back along with the original message, and when you look out onto the object, you will not see the object. You will see something of the object plus a lot of forms from the memory. Now, when this happens, you are asleep. It can immediately be seen that if you do not gain the power to separate out the memory of the empirical experience from the logical function here, which defines things as straight, curved, etc., and both of these from the perceptual image, that you cannot remain in contact with the extant physical situation. And there will be seepage of the memory over the percept, with a consequent falsification. Now, in yoga, we have to join ourselves, yoga means join, to reality, that is, to whatever is. And in each situation, there is something, and we must disjoin the memory so that the memory doesn't seep over it and put us to sleep. Now, we can see that this cannot do us any harm at all if we practice waking up, actually looking in the external physical world and seeing what there is, as opposed to what the memory superimposes on what there is. We've seen it before. If I draw two triangles, one with the apex at the top and one at the bottom, and then put a couple of legs there, as soon as we put these diagrams into a more human form, we can see immediately that the significance of those triangles is changed. Instead of being mere triangles, they now rouse in the memory certain anthropomorphic memories and certain biological ones, such that a man looking at this form here would tend to have his consciousness drop down onto this low base, and he would tend not to bother about this one with the high base. Now, this is an observed fact inside your mind, that the idea that this one might be a lady immediately arouses something other than the geometrical appreciation of the triangle. And this is superimposition. This superimposition is part of Maya, part of illusion. And it goes on all day and in all situations until you learn to cut it. So in yoga, when they're talking about this epistemological problem, how do we see, what do we see, it is said a message comes from the outside object, hits the receiving organ, creates an after motion in there, constructs the external situation, sends a message through to the logical faculty, which determines what it is, and memory flashes back with it. Now all these different things have to be cut. We have to learn how to see exactly what is. If we practice very carefully, we can actually become aware of retinal stimulation without the formation of the after image. But this is a quite advanced exercise to be able to concentrate on the back of your eye so that you're no longer aware that there is an object outside. That is actually how the baby sees it for the first time. A baby has no concept initially that the light that it sees is outside. It is simply inside the consciousness of the child. It has to learn by physical motions and its arms, legs and so on that there is an outside, and the outside to which it refers is not outside consciousness, it is outside the limits of its physical body. Now, struggling against sleep, as here defined, is obviously the same thing as practicing yoga. While we are awake, we must look at the exact physical situation. We must not allow any memory whatever to obscure the fact, but when memories rise, we don't have to stop them. We can see them as memories, so that we don't have to eliminate them. See them as memories, and see where they would tend to fuse with the extant object, and stop that process, and thereby evaluate the situation exactly. A man came to see me today, and he's going to get married again. And the funny thing he said was that some years ago, about 1942, we had a discussion about types, marrying types, characters and so on, and he's only just realized that his new wife is exactly the same as the old one, physically and temperamentally. He's gone out, he's left one, and he's sought another, and he has been guided by his idea of what he wanted, and he's kept on the move until he's seen another one like it, and he's then committed himself to it. But he did have the sense to say that there is a difference between these two, because although they are physically and psychologically very, very similar, about the second one I have no unpleasant memories yet. See? So there was a slight inclusion. So you have learned to separate out something of the memory concept from the extant situation. So I think that will do about sleep, as a biggie said here. It has been implied from certain remarks that a handful of conscious men have certain world situations under control. Does this tie up with the idea of schools and esoteric circles in humanity? If it does, can it be indicated to what extent these people have power to interfere with men's general leaning towards self-destruction? Well, anybody who reads history intelligently at all is forced to admit that a handful of men have always determined the general mass movement of humanity. They have arranged wars. It's not so very long ago since William the Conqueror and his boys. It is known historically that the Normans and some other people connected with them and the Mithras actually had a belief that the proper function of man was making war and keeping fit, and that any beings who did not agree with them were simply fodder. And there was a tacit agreement that if two gentlemen owning vast estates felt like a fight, they would communicate with each other about the fight, and they would arrange to get an army up on each side and to stage a war, and that they themselves would wear insignia so that they could not be mistaken for somebody else, and that they would never kill each other. But that the ordinary people should be killed as much as possible to make it interesting. Now, it may sound like a game, and it has been a game historically, but there are apologists for it, like Malthus, with his population theories. When a man makes a statement that the food increases on Earth in considerably less quantities than the number of people on Earth, and therefore people on Earth must reach a point on which the Earth is saturated and there is insufficient food for them, it is then time to kill off a lot of people. And it has been stated, and he was actually a minister of the church who stated it, that wars are necessary for reducing the masses of people down to the level of the available food, and that these things would have to be arranged if they didn't occur spontaneously. Now, we do know that most people, using the word people technically, don't like war. And the only way you can make them make war is by telling them that their girlfriends or wives or grandmothers are highly desirable and that somebody is likely to run off with them if they don't fight, which is a ritual in pacifist tribunals. What will you do if somebody came to rape your grandmother? That isn't a joke, it actually occurs in tribunals. The statement is made that there is a handful of conscious men who train themselves very, very hard. If you like to read, for instance, the history of the cult of Mithras, you know that Mithras was a Persian semi-divine being, and he's represented as killing a bull. Now this bull signifies the earth and the earthbound people, and he himself is a sun being, a being from the sun, an illuminated being of will and light. The sun gives light and heat. The heat is the energy and the light is his understanding. When Christianity was presented to the Roman Empire, it had a fight with the Mithraic cult, because the Romans were militaries and naturally were Mithraic in their inclinations, as were the Germans. And you may have noticed that in recent archaeological diggings in London, some Mithraic remains were dug up there. Now this cult was a cult in which it was stated that men, to be men, must fight, and that they have to fight the earth and everything inertic. That they were men of will, men of the sun, men of light and understanding. All the great emperors have believed in this. Napoleon was a Mithraist in this sense. And Mithraism would have been the religion of Rome, but for one thing. You cannot make mass conversions to a religion that requires intelligent appreciation of what the religion is about. For which reason Mithraism itself was thrown out. And Christianity was introduced in its stead because it had only one rule, and a very simple one. You don't need to understand anything. Only believe, and it shall be, etc. Now, because nothing was required of people other than this belief, Christianity was taken over as a unity principle by what was, in effect, a materialistic government. Now, it is known and admitted in works on the history of the Church that when Constantine the Emperor was converted, he was converted for political convenience. Not because he was a religious man, but because he saw that only through the taking over of Christianity into the state could he possibly solve the political problems he had. The Christians were arguing amongst themselves at the time, and they were threatening to split his empire. If he became official, he could then become the official head of a church. Now, when he did so, then Christianity immediately ceased to be what Christ had said it was. Christ had said, "My kingdom is not of this world." Constantine said when he saw the cross, it meant to him, in hoc signo vincus, in this sign, it's a new triumph, and he was a militarist. So he saw that as a militarist, he could utilize the Christian idea. But then it became no more the Christian idea. What happened was, as soon as he, the emperor, was converted, then instead of the church being full of faithful people who were belonging because they believed, suddenly it became fashionable because the emperor joined. And as soon as the emperor joined and it became fashionable, it became the very antithesis of what Christ had set out to make it. Now, this handful of men have actually distorted Christianity so much that practically the whole of Christian writing from the time of Constantine has not been purely Christian at all. It has taken over and inserted into the Christian method another method, the method not of training for the next world, of training for spirit, of training to be free and non-materialistic. It has taken over all the cult of the militaries, of the sun gods and supermen, and inserted it into the Christian religion to such effect that unless you go through all the Christian writings very carefully, you cannot sort out the statements that are made. Even Christ himself is said in a hymn to be an S-U-N, as well as an S-O-N of God. And this is an official title of this militaristic Mithras. So in effect, this handful of men have conditioned for the last, well, that we know of, certainly 6,000 years, that these sun men have come down. We see their monuments, we see the kind of thing they use as their symbol, a solar disk with wings, the serpents with it, and so on. We see these symbols carried down. The sun gives heat, energy, and light, understanding. Those who have energy and understanding are fitted by heaven, by solar radiations, and their part absorbent, to dictate the situation to the lower level or masses called people. So, can it be indicated to what extent these people have power to interfere with man's general leaning towards self-destruction? Man's general leaning towards self-destruction isn't towards self-destruction as defined. People are not defining self-destruction as desirable. They are merely running towards it through inertias established in them by this handful of men. The same handful of men who are distorting facts now, consciously, about the situation in South Africa, about the situation in Kenya, about the situation in Israel and elsewhere. This handful of men, by a few radio programs, TV programs, newspaper articles, completely swing public opinion. That these men exist, and that they do not publish their real opinions, is a ground for saying that there is an esoteric school. But these men are chet men. They are not the men that run esoteric schools of the spiritual order. And this has to be distinguished very carefully. You remember our division we did some time ago? We said that we would make a hierarchy. We would put inside Q in an inner circle to signify the sexual reaction level, and that is the sign of people as such. And round those, to keep them in order, we would put K, which symbolizes intellectuals. And that intellectual there is only a man in the administration. He's not Napoleon. He's one of the bookkeepers who tells him how many loaves he's got to put in the bellies of the army that's marching on it. And outside is the hetman, who is the power man. I'll put a little C in front of that. You can pronounce it like the Scottish loch, because it implies effort. That H is a spiritual letter, but when it's made slightly hard into this guttural, then it means effort, individual effort. Hitler, Napoleon, Stalin, even Mussolini made efforts. Now, all the hetmen are the individuals who utilize the kapmen, or intellectuals, to control the kochmen, or sexually orientated. Now, beyond the individual is the universal, which we represent by E, although it's really a soft aspirate. I'll put a small H in front of it. Now, that means the universal consciousness. This means individual, great man. This means rationalist or intellectualist. And this means ordinary man in the street, sexually orientated. Over here is Aleph, the absolute. So this He level here, which is represented by the letter E, signifies the universal consciousness. The absolute is the same as God the Father here, where he hits the universal boundary and keeps it in being, making a firmament. The macrocosmic sphere now exists, and internal to it, it individualizes itself through the waves within macrocosmos, spreading about within that sphere and intersecting. And at each intersection point, it breeds a chetna, a power man. This is an individual who sets out to dominate by individual effort. All the great heroes and the ancient world are chetman in this sense. If they then decide that they will use their power gained by individual effort to control people lower than they are, they will get around the administrators to take care of the territories that they pinch by force. And these administrators will then take the people who are in those territories and who are so busy multiplying and creating tomorrow's food problem that they haven't time to become intellectual or hit themselves. When we talk about the esoteric, we are talking about something quite other than the chetman in the individual sense. Montgomery is a chetman. Every great militarist is a chetman in that sense. If you take this German word, you see, that is the best word we have for it. A chetman is the German word for what we call in English a headman. That's a sound shift from T to D. Now, ordinary people in German are not called man in that sentence. They're Leute. It has a sufficient similarity to an English word to let you know what it means. These Q men are named from this fact. The circle there means female, and the straight line means male. And if they are preoccupied with that activity, and they will never do anything other than that activity, as long as they're not too tired, then quite obviously they must constitute the fodder for the activities of all the levels above them. When this mass of levels is thoroughly appreciated, then all the mystics and all the esotericists, from recent ones like Uspensky, who is really a K-man, and Gurdjieff, who is a Het-man, to say Krishnamurti, who is an He-man, he believes in the universal. When all these levels are seen, you can then understand and place within this diagram the different men. Now, if we say that as far as the cork man, and it's the copper man, copper belongs to Venus, doesn't it? Convince the act of copulation. And when we start with that level, and we wish to transcend it, we have to find the reason, the rationale which governs it. If we then discover that the cause of it is that the absolute energy goes into the center of being and then presses out again to pluralize itself, then we see that inside every individual this procreative urge is not an individual urge, but an absolute energy coming through it in order to fill the cosmos with thoughts. Now, if you don't like being merely a reproductive device for this absolute energy, and you begin to reason about it, you climb out of the cork level onto the cap level. At the cap level, then, you have to discover the reason for this lower Q activity. You see what it means. It's quite justified, absolutely. because the antidote works through people, makes seeds and reproduces and fills the universe. But its object is to subdue it. It just doesn't want to fill it. It wants to order it. So when you reason about it to a certain degree, you discover that you don't reason about it just to reason about it, but in order to order it. And therefore you realize that there must be another kind of activity, the activity of the Chetman, who has to order it. Now, you then start to climb up to the Chetman level. When you get to Chetman level, you are able to apply acts of will back on the rationalists who've not quite worked it out, and back on the Q-boys who are totally unaware that there is anything other than their own occupation. Now at this level you can, as a Chetman, say, I will rule in the world of individuals for myself as an individual. If you do so, you are then one of the lower Chetmen. Nietzsche would have called these lower Chetmen higher men, whereas the higher Chetmen he called supermen. A higher man is only a higher man relative to a lower one, whereas the Chetman superman has become his own sense of value, and he's not concerned now with ruling these things down below for his own individual end, but he now has an idea that the whole process could be lifted up. The whole mass of the universe could be lifted up to a higher level, and all the values of the individuals within it, whether they like it or not, could be elevated. That Q folk could be diverted to another subject. That rationalists could be made to feel power, and that power could elevate itself up to the universal. Now, it's in these supermen, or the higher Chetmen, that we find this esotericism properly beginning to break through from the universal. But it can only occur when the individual strong man abandons the will to dominate below him for his own individual effort and for his own individual self-picture, and to realize that there is work to be done for the universe. And at that point he starts moving towards the universal. Now if he breaks through into the universal, he abandons his individual effort as an individual, and he identifies with the universal. And then the energies from the absolute coming through the universal come into his mind. He's almost on the borderline. And he can take the energies of the universal, see their direction, and then work upon the ones below to make them move. Q-man, he sees the absolute energy to run through them all. And in so doing, he operates at all levels absolutely. And again, this brings us back to the immediacy we discussed before. At all other levels, we have been doing something for something else. We have been trying to understand the Q level to climb onto the K or intellectual level. We've tried to find out what the reasoning process was for, and discovered for ordering or some duty. We've tried to find out why we should bother to order anything at all, because of the universal. It's always been a means to something. But when we come to the absolute level, it is no longer one thing done in order that another should be done. It is the absolute working at each level, simultaneously with all other levels, and all towards the same end. Now, you can see immediately that as the absolute energy comes through the Q level to reproduce, that the lower down the scale we go, the greater the number of products of reproduction there will be. In other words, the larger families will occur down here because of their concentration on that center. Now imagine the absolute to be an infinite field. If that field remains infinitely extended, then there is no pressure developed by it.
But if it circumscribes itself universally, it's also when it changes the pressure from Aleph to Hay. If it then circumscribes again, it increases the pressure. Circumscription again, the pressure goes up. Circumscription again. So at the sexual level, there's a terrific amount of pressure developed such that the individual at that level is bound to leak. That is to say, he's bound to reproduce. And he will go on reproducing until that energy drops sufficiently low, and then he might start to think. Now, because when that energy is coming through that center and a man is identified, nothing can be done about it in the identification. Therefore, William Blake said, the man who thinks he can control his desire has a very weak desire. You can't begin to control that if you are identified with it. Control is the same thing as separation from and observation from outside. So if you want to control Q, you have to rise up to K. But if you want to control your reason, you'll have to rise up to individual will. This individual will appear as the individual will to power. If you want to transcend the individual will to power, you must then assume the universal will. And if you want to transcend the universal will, you must climb up to the non-dual Anshin. I'm going to leave that a moment and look at a problem of the interpenetration of spheres, because it is very important in relation to this idea. We have said that we could cover the whole of the paper in little circles. All these circles would represent ripples, each one having its own center. And that if the paper extended infinitely and we were to have eternity to draw in, we could cover it with a ripple diagram. Now, what does it mean to be separate and at the same time to be interpenetrating? The simplest number we can deal with is 2. If we take the center of 1 and let a ripple propagate to a certain distance and count that distance as another center and draw another circle, we then see that the perimeter of A is on the center B and the perimeter of B is on the center A. Imagine this paper is spirit, which is initiative, intelligence, power, and it is vibrating at points. It vibrates throughout itself, and at every point where it develops an impulse, as it presses down, it reacts back and presses up. And the product of this is a ripple. Now, throughout space, there are centers. And every other center acts as a reflection point to turn back the ripple from every other center. So if A sends a ripple, B, a center, reflects that ripple back to our day. We now see that at the initiation point A, there will be the affirmation of a certain characteristic vibration, which we'll call the A vibration. At the center B is another vibration characterized as B. And as we go away from any given center, the influences of other centers will increase. So we have at the center of every being the greatest degree of individuation. And as we are moving away from that center, we're moving towards another center, also individuated. And in the space between, we are traversing a space with ripples from both those centers. Now these ripples are mutually interpenetrating. So that if we identify with the space between, we will have a complex vibrational structure AB. This will remind us about the sleep concept again. Because if we want to understand A exactly, we must identify with the individuation center of A. If we identify with the space between, we'll identify with B as well. So wherever there is a center of impulse, we have a unique individual. But as soon as you get off the center, then you have a contested zone full of the motions from other centers. Now, inside every human being, as just one of the kinds of beings there are, there is such a center. The fact that an individual human being has a perimeter at all means that he has a differentiating factor in him that keeps him from being other beings. If you think about it very carefully, you'll discover that you must be unique because your skin excludes the skin of another being. Because were you not unique in that way, you would fuse together. So this differentiating factor is the same as the individuation impulse from the center of a being. Now imagine the whole thing is in an infinite field, but the center B is vibrating in the character B. We'll actually use the form of B, the letter B. So that means that center is vibrating as B, and as we move away from it, the vibration of character A here is beginning to obscure the B. Inside every individual being, there is a characterizing central impulse. When you come to the edge of your gross body, it isn't in this contested zone here. It is very close. So if I draw a circle round the center B and another one round the center A, such that those two circles now touch, you have a contingent relation at the gross material level. But the other relation here of the field is still mutually interpenetrating. There's our center of individuation. Here is the gross body limit, and that is the limit determined by the strength of the impulses from here, where they meet the similar impulses from another center and generate between them a wall. Now that is a firmament generated between them. And it is that firmament that is the evidence of their unique individual formal structure. If they were to vibrate in exactly the same manner, on coming together they would fuse. Just like certain notes in music get together, like the harmonics do. Now if we take this initial fact that the limiting factor imposed on any center is the center of another one, we can see that if the small circle represents the gross body, then this interpenetrating field here represents the subtle body and those beings. And if we draw another circle round both here, we can see that that large circle is the unifying field of those two in relation. Now the same thing can go on with bigger circles, and we draw exactly the same diagram again all over the paper. Now it is only a question of identification with a given limit whether you are separate or not. Nothing but identification. Remember that the paper represents spirit, which is intelligence, consciousness, initiative. But when that paper spirit initiative piles up its energies at a given limiting factor, it and nothing else is imposing on it. Every imposition is self-imposition. The mystic who said, "I am my own executioner," was referring to that fact, that we impose on ourselves our own limitations by identifying with given levels of being. If I identify with my gross material body and say this is all there is, this is the total reality, then I must believe that that other material body is separate from myself and other than I am, and where it doesn't conform to my will, I must hit it if I can. If that is total reality, if materialism is true, we have no ground whatever for bothering to consider anything other than the wants which present themselves inside the given physical body with which we are identified. A And as soon as we find that there is a medium of exchange in the realm of ideas, that we can exchange ideas, and yet the physical bodies don't come closer together, it means that in the subtle world we have already something transcending the limitations of the physical body. Now, you know that when two people become fond of each other, their physical body separateness initially annoys them. They are aware of their absolute non-duality underneath. Plato and some others thought about this, that two people falling in love at the sexual level really belong together. There was a prior unity in eternity which had been split on entering into time, and the two halves are now being driven together. Now, that would be true if it weren't for the remarkable capacity of human beings to get this same feeling with quite a lot of people. So it isn't a question of you just having one other heart. You've got a lot of other hearts. And this constitutes one of the major problems of relation. If we see that underneath us all the time, represented by the white paper, this spirit says, this dualism is not absolute. So that when a person who has been isolated by identification with the physical body, by chance, been swept into awareness that its physical body exists, it desires the elimination of that limiting factor. Wants to rub that line out. If at that moment somebody comes along and behaves in a kind manner, then it is drawn towards it, and the two of them tend to try to make themselves even physically one. So you'll get Heinrich Heine saying that he will be buried in the same coffin with his girlfriend. And it becomes even a matter of importance to get the two corpses in the same coffin. Now this is this striving for unity of the discrete gross bodies. It occurs in calf love and in early puberty experiences that boys and girls feel the necessity for breaking this differentiation, this separation of the gross bodies. They fail. Then gradually there arises the idea that it might be possible to have a kind of unity of viewpoint, even if we can't fuse physical bodies because the resistance is so tremendous. Nevertheless, we might fuse together our minds. We get the period through which young people go, they call it the platonic love period, when they say, well, we're not interested in sex as such because we have similar minds. Now this is a unity principle, and they develop it by seeking each other's ideas out and seeing whether they agree with them. And if they do, and the ideas are easily exchanged, they build a body of ideas between them. Now this body is not a myth. A definite amount of energy, and it is more subtle than the gross body, and it can become so very, very strongly brought into consciousness from the two partners that even at a distance, if one of the partners begins to change its mind, the other one begins to feel robbed and rushes to the telephone to see what this funny thing is. There is such an affinity developed between them. Now sometimes the ideas, after a long time of trying to work them out together, clash, won't fit together, and therefore you must start treating the idea bodies as separate. And then you have another problem. Whether you should say, I have nothing to do with a person who has no idea similar to my own, or I will find another level of unity. Now the level of unity higher than the idea unity is willing to be one with somebody regardless of what they do or think. You find that mothers do this with their children. If the boy is a bad boy, the mother doesn't care. It's her boy. It's her boy who murdered that fellow. Not just any old boy. And therefore special dispensations are required. This is a will to retain a unity in the face of gross material separation and a complete lack of unity of idea. We are moving towards, again, this concept that cause, which is will, is not dual. when we think of this very carefully now, in relation to an individual, we can see that whenever there is a membrane in the body separating off the different functions of the body, we can postulate a centre. So if we take the three-part man here, we have a centre, we say it's the navel, roughly. From that centre, certain forces have gone out to a limiting factor. Over here there's a heart centre, which has sent out others, and up there there's an intellectual centre. And they have created firmaments between them. The one between the lower abdomen and the chest is the diaphragm. And in the case of the head and chest, the thing got pushed to such a point that it grew itself a neck to keep the distance between them for certain functional reasons. Now, we can identify with any one of those centres, and if we do so, we find definite individuated tendencies to action, to feeling, to function. And they change as we change our centres of idea, our references, our identification centres. When we look at the diagram of the separation of gross bodies in individual people and realise that the cause of it is the central impulse broadcasting out and creating a ripple, and that it is sufficiently intense to reject a counter ripple from another zone, we've seen that the separation of individuals depends entirely on their strength, their relative strength. When we look at the single human being with his three parts, we see again that if there is separation between urge, feeling and thinking, it is evidence that the centre of urge, of feeling and thinking must be strong. You see the function of esotericism and the hetman here, because it was through an esoteric message that the individuals who became hetmen began to work. They said, the only way we can avoid confusion, non-discrimination, is to strengthen our centres in ourselves. Because if we don't have strong centres, we can't create firmaments between them. So they set up initiation rites and test actions, and there were the three orders. You had to have an urge, and you had to have a feeling and a thinking test. This is the origin of ordinary school exams. Actually, you go in for games, and they had very rough games, and you find that there are certain people today connected with the Edinburgh School, who are starting this same educational process again, where they're using purely physical activities to train the urge level to make it strong. When you push yourself as far as you can with your urge, you will discover that when your urge is pushed to the limit, a feeling will develop in you, and you will have to change phase. You will have to become a feeling being, or push your urge further still. If you push it to the limit as far as you can and keep trying, you become overheated, you become emotional, you may cry, you may do anything. You may notice with little children, it takes boys because they're more likely to do it, in natural mythos themselves. You may see a little boy, I've seen this quite often, trying to do something too big for him, trying to pick up a stone that's very heavy, and failing to do it, bursting into tears, and struggling with it while he is crying. Now, while he is struggling and crying, he's on this line, just between the belly and the heart. You see, and you notice his diaphragm, he's banging about, and he's sobbing terribly, and his chest is convulsively working. He's trying to get the limits of his urge power, to see where it is. And when he comes near the limit, he starts crying. He starts crying because he has an idea up here that he ought to be very strong, and something is beating him. And the disparity between the idea that he should be strong and his actual performance, which is far lower than his idea, produces this emotional discharge. Now, if we go to the other end, to train the mind has to be trained in rigid, cold logic with the same amount of effort that was expended on trying to climb that mountain or swim that river. When you have trained yourself in pure logic and pure urge, and you've driven your logic to the point of emotional breakdown, and your urge to the point of emotional breakdown, you then have an idea of your limits, and you can work to extend those limits intelligently, but only again by effort. You're learning pure logic there, quite cold, and you're learning body action there, and here you are learning aesthetic appreciation, which will tell you by feeling when a given logic should not be pushed further, or when a given act has reached the term defined by the logic. Now there is a threefold initiation, and you will see from it that if you actually do drive yourself to do anything at all at the body level, no matter what it is, it could be getting a piece of wood or getting a chair, if you like, get a chair, hold it in one hand and lift it up, hold it up, see if you can hold a chair out in your hand for 3 minutes. If you can do 3 minutes too easily, make it 4, 5, 6. Hold it out until you have a fight with yourself. Now it obviously needs intelligence to do this, because you could start at the wrong end and drop a ton of coal on your head to test your skull. Or you could analyse your body by putting it through the mangle. But that is not intelligent. And the only possibility of an abuse of an exercise is by unintelligent application of it. Take any physical act at all, and make yourself do it more than you think you can do it. And watch yourself very carefully to see at what point you start becoming dithering in the emotions. You discover if you set yourself a given target and then you begin to fail, then your self-opinion there begins to work and rationalize why you shouldn't do it today. You will find that the thinker there will say, well, I think I've done enough for today. The important thing to do is make a target and fulfill it. And if it's fulfilled too easily, make another target that you think will be a little bit difficult. And go on doing this and continuously extending the target. And then you will discover the limits of these three functions in the body. And in the process, you will be separating out or making discriminate the three functions of your pure logic, your aesthetic sense, and your body action. Now, when they have become perfectly separated out, which they can only become under these super efforts, and you've made your firmaments between, then you can coordinate them in the fourth level. You can't coordinate the confused, and you cannot discover in the confusion what is causing confusion unless you actually drive yourself at these three levels. When you do so and create your firmaments between, then you can clearly coordinate these three things in the fourth.
Thank you, 6-4.
Now you have a bull down in the belly, you have a lion in the heart, and an eagle in the head, and the man who is to coordinate them. Those are the four parts of the Sphinx. Now you know that the Sphinx is very old, so this concept of the man with his three parts, his all-seeing intellect and its logical capacity for seeing patterns, the courage of the lion, and this capacity for bearing burdens of the bull, that dreadful strength of the bull. So although it's quiet, it just goes on and does the job. When you have got your bull, lion, eagle thoroughly separated, then they are coordinated and the man's face appears on the Sphinx. But that cannot be done while the three functions are confused.
Could you just say a few words about the initial impulse export point? This is room in the car if I'm ready.
Good night.
As to their eternality, prior to creation, it just, well, I was thinking here that creation is eternal in its process.
Well, this is a question of identification again. Let the faith represent eternality. The simultaneous impulsations throughout it are also eternal. The question of creation, then, is a question of identification. If you identify with a given level, a given ripple, it becomes created for you at that moment.
There was then a first one, or there wasn't, is a question of...
Well, it's a paradoxical reply, isn't it? Saturn, this original impulse here, occurs simultaneously throughout the whole of eternality. And if it had not done so, it could never have done so. If you take a temporal concept of a first action, you cannot create that first action, because you are postulating a prior state of non-action, and you cannot introduce into that prior state the concept of action without introducing it from outside. And there is no outside of the infinite. So the absolute has for its essential character motion. That motion is impulsive throughout, and creation is a method of identification. So as far as the gross materialist is concerned, spirit doesn't exist, has not been created. Ideas as such do not exist. But only motions of physical bodies exist. So gross materialists, we say, a Watsonian, New Yorkian, mechanical behaviourist, you see, would believe that thought and all the other processes in the mind are simply the behaviours of gross matter. So for him there is no idea beyond that, and there is no spirit beyond that. They don't exist, they haven't been created. On the other hand, for a person, you can treat them with drugs or with hypnosis and so on, but a person no longer identified with the gross physical body, physical bodies have not been created. The fact that we tend to concentrate on this gross body is only a statement about an identification process that goes on, and we are identified with the inswing of it rather than the outswing. Remember what we said before about a small circle there being kept by a larger one, and to the small one, that rotation there, the larger one must seem to be a transcendent force entering into it without prediction.
It's a serial presentation that creates the problem, of course.
And the serial presentation is through identification with finite.
So that impulse takes itself, motion doesn't become a rotation until identification takes place.
That's right, that's right. This is the meaning of Brahma's statement that the turning wheel stands still when the will has been reconceived. It is apparently a rotation. For instance, take a fact. If I draw a circle like this, and you look at it very carefully, you will find that your attention is running round it. Try and stop it. Try and see that not as a rotation. See if you can hold the mind in suspense so that your attention does not run round the circle. If you can succeed in doing so, you have broken the rotation tendency in the mind. It isn't on the paper. The paper hasn't got a rotation on it. It's merely got so much carbon and wax on it. Nevertheless, the attention, that peculiar tendency of consciousness, which a spirit is essentially dynamic, to make that which is not actually rotating, rotate. But the rotation is only apparent. In fact, if we take
supposing we took a proton with an electron dashing around it. You see, if we try to find out what that electron is that is going around it, we find that it has no being of its own at all.
63,
63 to 6,
are you available, over?
It hasn't got a being of its own. It's a function in a field. And if you like to think of the wave on the sea building itself up and apparently travelling along, you know that in fact the little molecules of water there and just lifted up and down in their own plane in succession, and no such wave has gone. There's merely been a motion at right angles to the line of the wave. And this wave is a construct. Now all the motion in the world is constructed in the same way. Sometimes under certain drugs people have said it can be experienced with the appropriate exercises. Suddenly the world stands still. It does. Because at that moment you have not identified with a bit of it. You've suddenly seen all of it. And suddenly a voice will chop in the middle. And the thing becomes static. Simply because you've transcended the identification of the moment. Suppose we take a diagram which we might have seen Leonardo trying to work out in a man, the rotation of an arm. There's the point where the humerus fits into the scapula, and it will rotate on that point. So if you draw a circle around the arm, we can place the different positions of the upper arm with the elbow on that perimeter. And if we want the forearm, it rotates on the elbow, like that. And if we want the hand, it rotates on the wrist, like that. And all the various positions of hand will be a circle there. All the various positions of forearm are the circle there, and the shoulder here. Now those are all the possible positions of arm. Now they coexist simultaneously in eternity. And by a shift of attention, it appears that some of them have been selected and made manifest in time. But that is merely putting a stress from here to here to here, and so on. So that all the real is simply a shift of stress identification. And remember, to be non-dualistic about it, there is not something other than spirit making this identification. There isn't anything other than spirit to make it. So that the identifying essence is spirit itself. And in the identification, it superstresses, out of all its total possibilities, the particulars that it feels like superstressing. And they then appear as gross material facts. You know Humphrey Davy's statement about a little, I think it was nitrous oxide he was using, demonstrating to some students, and he inhaled too much of it, and suddenly all the students disappeared, and he saw a little whirlpool sitting on the seats instead. Now, have they disappeared or not? He, for the rest of his life, did not believe in gross matter. He didn't say it was a temporary hallucination. He said that was a valid experience of another level. You might have seen a psychiatrist and I think it was a neurologist the other night in an interview. A very, very pathetic interview where he had four people who had been mentally ill. He defined them as ill. One of them was a girl who said that she had been religious before treatment, and after treatment she wasn't religious anymore. She used to believe in God. She even heard God's voice. But after shock treatment, God's voice didn't come anymore. Now, at the end of it, the psychiatrist said that science didn't really know that these things were impossible. But they did know that when they shocked people, they didn't occur again. And that for social integration reasons, you were better not hearing the voice of God. Because it upsets commerce and all sorts of things. The girl looked very, very sad that she once used to believe and now doesn't. And she accepted his definition that she was cured. Well, she was better socially, because the social existence doesn't require God's voice, does it?
But it really was pathetic to see it, because these two specialists, who talk theologically all the time, admitted that they had no ground for believing that her experience wasn't valid, but because she had mentioned it, she had been given treatment and the symptoms had disappeared. And it didn't prove that the symptoms weren't valid. It merely proved that they'd gone away after treatment. One lady had a lovely monkey on her back, and after treatment he wasn't there. That's a great pity, then. It might have been a very nice settled monkey if she'd have become friendly with it, like an old man I knew who had a lion. Similarly, she could have got it to do jobs for me. Only it was defined that it's not nice to have a nice woolly monkey on your back. And when she said, "I can feel its tail lying along my spine," well, a little bit of judicious electricity removes the tail. An old man I knew who was a very good practicing yogi, who identified with the lion off the Tower of Pack, didn't complain about it to a psychiatrist. They weren't even that popular then. And he trained it so well that it used to go to the door to see who was at the door and come back and tell him, so that if somebody didn't want to see, he didn't open it.
It has been suggested that from time to time a deliberate error is being introduced into your talks, and that the discovery of this error by the group or any member of the group is then an indication to you of the readiness, of their readiness, for more advanced ideas. Is there any truth in this suggestion? Well, if we remember that when Gautama was asked if he had kept anything back, he said he wasn't a man with a closed fist. And when Christ himself said something to his disciples about them receiving something that people in general could not receive, there was an implied esoteric teaching. In both cases, in Gautama's case, he denied that he himself had held anything back. In Christ's case, he said he had held something back. But in neither of those cases was there a statement that deliberate errors had been introduced in order to obviously test somebody's ability to detect errors. The suggestion here is that somebody has suggested that deliberate errors occur, which means that somebody may have detected an error. There was a thinker in the 19th century who said, "It is every man's duty either to teach or to be taught by every other man." If somebody did detect an error, it would be their human duty to me to tell me of the nature of the error to save me from continuing in that error, if there were one. Now, the only way that this could have arisen, to my mind, is possibly from two instances that I can think of where sense of humour on one occasion got the better of me, and a friend of mine with whom I've been discussing earlier about the fairy tale of the Princess and the Pea was terribly amused because we made a joke about the princess being so sensitive that she couldn't even feel a pea through the seven eyelids. Now, this obviously was an inversion. If she was so very sensitive, she shouldn't have been able to feel the pea through the seven eyelids. I'm afraid that sense of humour tends to run away with things like that. And I wouldn't call that a deliberate error to say that the princess was so sensitive she couldn't feel a peace. It was an ambulance. I should have thought that would have been self-evidently an error sufficient for everybody to detect it immediately, and for it not to be of any great moment in any case. Another one was that a few weeks ago I was discussing with a TV interviewer a project for a possible TV program in which some sketches were to be done, and at certain points in the sketches a deliberate error was going to be introduced into the TV program, but the viewers were to be warned beforehand that a deliberate error was going to be committed and that they had to detect it and then write up and say what they thought it was, and they would receive a magnificent prize or something like that. The illustration I gave was that I might say, I will now draw this man's cheekbone and instead draw the line of the jaw. It's slightly ambiguous. Some people might think it's all cheap. Yes, most of it is on TV now, of course. And from this could have arisen an idea in at least one person's mind that there was a deliberate error in the talks that he didn't hear. Now, it would be fundamentally wrong spiritually. You know what I've defined morals as? Convenient for the rulers. I've defined ethics as what rational men can be expected to do from their reason. But spiritually, that means in the movement towards freedom, it would be fundamentally wrong of any person deliberately to put forward an erroneous idea which could become a basis of action, and which may not be detected by large numbers of people, and which might result in them getting into trouble with themselves. I've seen it enough in mental hospitals for many years, since about 1932, of people suffering from their own ideas that have been acquired in odd moments in conversations. I've seen some suicides who have become suicides only through erroneous ideas, to know that it would be fundamentally inhuman deliberately to propagate an erroneous idea and use it as a means of somebody showing himself his own level of cleverness in discovering it. So I will say now, for any future occasions, if any error is detected in something I say, I personally would like to hear about it, because apart from such mad statements as the princess and the fee, I would not make an erroneous statement, knowing that every idea is an energy packet which must make its own associations in the mind, must produce complex ideas, and ultimately, by the feeling tone around it, pass into action and force people into behavior relations with other beings. I had recently a letter in which a statement was made that I had challenged somebody to do a certain thing. I had not challenged that person at all. I did make a statement that Christ had made a statement that constituted a challenge, but I did not make an individual and personal challenge to the person. It would not be for me to challenge another person to do something at all, because if for a moment that person were to be dominated by the challenge, which could only arise from a cumulative in any case, it would mean that the person would be pushed into action for which he was not yet equipped, and it must necessarily go wrong. So I will state now categorically that no deliberate errors are introduced, that I would consider the introduction of deliberate errors, as I said, not immoral, not unethical, but spiritually utterly unjustified, because it would constitute a definite misdirection, a lead towards false conjugations of ideas, and ultimately to erroneous activity which could only get that person into trouble and would result later in very, very hard work undoing it. One of the things we know about this is, in doing this kind of work, other people's eyes are on us. The cue motive, as we've defined it before, is so strong that if any man in a group of this size starts to do certain things, the cue elements in himself and in every other man are waiting to knock him down.
This we know from the function of the two elements as defined. So, we have to be on guard against this. And I repeat, there is no deliberate error at all. And if any error does creep in, I would like to hear about it. If it's other than the slip of the tongue, I will be surprised. Because the stuff that I'm talking about is not individual. And the organism through which it is coming has nothing to do with it. And if it had, I would personally suspect it, because the whole of the work is to destroy this individuality as an interference mechanism. We want to cut out individual interference and to get to the fundamental spirit, which is identical in all beings. The light that lights every man that comes into the world, not that lights a given man and darkens some other man. So if you do spot any errors, let me know about them. They will not be delivered. And I apologize for the consistent theme. Now, there's another one here. I had a very interesting letter the other day, which is very well thought out. I won't name the fellow because it is so well thought out that he might be very, very pleased. So I'll promise not to mention it to anybody there. He talked about the different levels of being. And the question has arisen from another source here, out of Bert's question. Is there any yardstick against which an individual wishing to apply special efforts in an attempt to accelerate his development may measure the right or wrongfulness of an act if he is in doubt? Is there a yardstick for handling situations of doubt? Now, the question from Bert, which he thought out very well, was one of levels. We put Q in the middle for this fundamental sexual drive which appears in the human being. And the human being is a hermaphrodite. He is will, feeling, which is female, and he is counting and intellectual initiative, which is male. Every being has these elements. And they are represented in the circle for the female aspects and the straight line for the intellective initiative aspects. Every being has this polarity within it. Now, the knowledge level, as we've shown, was that Q level where the absolute energy comes in and posits a formal entity as a vehicle for the reproduction of many such entities. And the absolute is working through that energy, and therefore no individual at the Q level can possibly control it. You get this in the statement that no man is continent except God wills it. Continent means containing his energies. Those energies are coming from the absolute, they're just going in, turning around and coming out. You can see immediately that it becomes an impossibility for a finite to hold infinite energy. The infinite prolific comes down, winds itself into an individual, splits itself into the various thermatic individuation forces, and presses out. No man can be continent except God wills it. The statement except God wills it means that under certain conditions the absolute will it. But that until for a given being, the absolute does will it. It is impossible for a man to contain those energies, to stop leakage. We'll see why as we go along. Now, in Bert's letter, he observed that each of these levels could be considered in the hierarchy as superior to the one below it, and therefore to be positive to it and to determine its activities. He then said that this was like magic working from a higher level onto a lower level. And he made the statement that each level could be defined by the level above as a black magic level. This is correct, isn't it?
Yes.
Now, we have these various levels, and up to the head level, we have the individual evolving under the pressure of absolute forces through the cue or sexual impulses, and then from those to the intellective impulses, from those into the individual power, the headman impulse, and all of those to the individual. Now, if the headman defines the K-man or the Q-man as inferior beings and defines whatever they do below him as black magic relative to his presence, that is his definition. But the three levels below are individuation levels. But the level above, the E level, the universal level, which is really a soft aspirate, is supra-individual, and therefore it has a universal right to define all those below insofar as they make individual efforts to blow Charlie and be all right, or to get his lifeboat and so on. All those things are defined by the universal as black magics. Now, you remember that we said some considerable time ago that black magic really was lack magic. This question of lacking magic, the bee is the house, you see. Magic is the production of changes in conformity with the will. Black magic means a relative lack of that power to produce changes, and therefore any being below a certain level lacks the magic of the level above it. We will now introduce into this, to be a little more precise, this statement, that in order to make magic, the will itself must produce changes in conformity and must make a definition. If there are any beings with the capacity to become aware of their will as a formative force, then we will say they are magical beings. But if there are any beings who are not aware of themselves as will, then they are not magical at all. Now, absolutely, we can say that it's all magical, but because it is all spirit, and spirit is power, and ultimately absolute will. So it is all magical. As we come from the absolute to the universal, the universal is a first order circumscription, and in this first order circumscription we have already a lack of the three absoluteness. So this A level, the E level, if you use the English alphabet, we're a little consistent about these letters, the E level corresponds with the macrocosmic Christ, who says, I do the will of my Father. It is the universal doing the will of the absolute. The absolute loves the world, so the absolute creates the world. So the first circumscribing, the big macrosphere, is the cosmic body of Christ. And it is responsive to the absolute frequency. And whatever the absolute frequency tries to do, the universal is listening to it, can feel the vibrations on its surface, and works to bring it to be in its interiorization process. So he says, I work, and my Father works. My Father works in secret, I work openly. And notice the strange fact that the secret is outside, it is transcendent, whereas the openness is on the inside, in the closed. This again is a paradox, not to do in the death. Now, when this universal is working, it is working to bring all beings to the will of the absolute. But the moment we go down to the headman level, we find the individual striving to feather his own nest regardless of the purpose of the universal or of the absolute. Now, it's at this point, in general, that we refer to black magic and the left-hand power. Remember, Christ sits at the right hand of God the Father. That is to say, he's at the hand of power. That is the absolute. And the power of the absolute comes immediately to the universal. But the universal filters that power, so that when the head level gets it, the H level, the individual power man gets it, it is already second hand. It has been filtered by the universal. So therefore, no individual can ever gain control of the absolute. This is very important. And why Christ says, no man comes to the Father except through me. No inner circle can get to the infinite without traversing the binding circles that enclose it. So no man comes to the Father, absolute, but by me, through Christ. The word lack now takes on its real importance, because this LK function here, if you see the word like, and reversing the word kill, which you don't like, has to do with the tying up and closing of anything whatever. Now, you can see there is no lack in the matter cosmic, although there is a lack. Because his determination to agree absolutely with the absolute keeps the universal will in exact phase with the absolute will. So although the Son could not of himself do those things universally, yet because of his absolute agreement with his absolute Father, there is no lack in him. And therefore it says, the Father gives all power into the hands of the Son. So the absolute gives all his power into the hands of the universal Christ. And there is no lack. So although there is a circumscription in bringing into existence the universe, it is not called a lack, although the same function is used in LK. It is the same as lack or the lick. And you'll notice here a peculiar relation between that lick and the lick, but with a Y, which means wolf. You know the lycanthropy, the werewolf thing, which hits Sunday newspapers periodically, which is based on this LK function. Because when the universal sphere is made, it constitutes a great appetite, which is a wolf, which Shakespeare in Troilus and Cressida calls the universal wolf, because it is like a great mouth. But that mouth is filled with the absolute. And the energy of the absolute filling that becomes the successive inner layers within the universe. So we do not really apply the expression lack in the sense of deficiency until we come to the head level, because it is individuated, and as long as it is struggling as an individuated being for its own individual ends, it necessarily lacks in the sense of being deficient that which the universal could give it if it could bring itself into conformity with the universal. The Hetman now filters the energy from the universal and deliberately keeps a secret from the K-man. The Hetman does not let the K-man know that he is using individual will. Those of us who saw Ross, Lawrence of Arabia last night, and have seen a play about a man who said, my trouble is I have worshipped an idol, a finite, the will. He had worshipped this. Those who know the history of Lawrence will remember that from a very early stage he was hammering himself through various levels to develop his will for the job he had to do in Arabia. And yet he saw that working for this individual will was not enough, and that he would have to transcend it. To work in this individual manner, he had to beat down the reason in himself which said he couldn't do it. For instance, Lawrence, as a young man at the university, used to go for long walks, and he used to hold his breath and tried to force himself to walk without breathing until he came to the end of his capacity. And the reason said, you can't do this. And when the reason said, you can't do it, he did it. He did some more of it until he was exhausted completely. This is the basis of the possibility of his work later. The Hetman suppresses the reason's voice. The individual Hetmen suppress the reason men, the rationalists, and tell them what they believe to be a lie. They tell them it is a good to be rational. Because if the rationalists knew that Hetmen do not use their reason, but only their will to power, then many of the rationalists would start trying to be willful. And if there became too many headmen, then there would be confusion. You see, the pyramid depends upon the rule. The higher they go, the fewer. So if we put the bricks in the pyramid and say the headmen are somewhere about, we'll have to finish the pyramid to be accurate, the flat top, and the brick that's not on it, the ghost brick, is the absolute. The top brick is the universal, and below this are a few H-men, headmen. Now, if all the people below were told that by individual will one can overthrow any system whatever within, there would be a considerable number of attempts made to overthrow it. And confusion would arise, and there'd be lots of bricks coming from below to try to make the pyramid this shape, each one would dash up, and the whole thing would become confused. So the headmen, who only rule by act of will, never admit it. They always pretend that they are rational. Now, the rationalist men are very, very fond of being reasonable, and they're very fond of being told by the headmen that it's a very good thing to be reasonable. You may remember that Churchill, on one occasion, who allows himself to be printed and titled as a Titan, this another gentleman, which is another headman, and that feed him out of the Old Testament, said, "I don't know any arithmetic. Never was any good at it, but I can always buy one if I want one. An arithmetician." Now this is the whole point about it. The headman can employ a clerk, a caveman, or a mathematician. The men that have actually been employed by the headman to make H-bombs and were led to drop them on Hiroshima and Nagasaki do not themselves admit their position. The rationalists who worked out the mathematics of the bomb and made it possible were pushed around by the H-men who couldn't understand the mathematics of the bomb. But they thought it was tremendously interesting for their purpose. We have found, and we actually have printed, even in a nice popular paper, like the New Scientist, 18 months ago, that, and you'll find an article in which a statement is made by the editor of a very, very responsible science magazine, Nature, one of the best, that scientists, that is, K-men, were now known to be being bribed. And that it was no longer true to say that science was committed to truth, and that in all the different countries of the world, scientists would exchange ideas freely in the name of truth. Something more than truth was at stake. Power. The scientists were declared in sufficient numbers to make it uncomfortable to be receiving bribes to distort facts, to conceal information, all because they have now reached a level where they could make very powerful weapons. The H-men, the power men, were utilizing these scientists, these mathematicians, and glorified clerks. And those clerks, doing their mathematics, could not see that they were being utilized by the H-men, but they knew there was something tremendous above them, and a little pat on the head saying, "You make me a bigger bomb and I like you. After all, you're terribly clever, your mathematics. And I just don't understand pi to the nth at all. But I do understand what I want, and what I'm going to get. And if you don't get it for me, I shall remove you and find somebody who will." These removals have occurred. In Italy, they would call it during the war doing a balmo. Now, this process of dictatorship by the headmen on the rationalists below them is of tremendous importance for the problem we have been set about how do we choose in a situation of doubt about what we shall do. Doubt implies doubleness. It means that there is a choice. Which of two acts shall we choose once we have realized that all levels inside the universal, the H, the K, and the Q level, are inferior to the universal, and each one is inferior to the one above it, and the Q one is the lowest. Supposing a headman, Mr. Bert Wilson, for instance, is about to launch forth in the field of business. Now, as soon as he begins to consider himself in the field of business, he knows he's up against other heads. That is, men in the same business, or an allied business. How shall he choose whether he shall foist his wares on the unsuspecting cuboids, because they are the market? What shall he do about it? Shall he just go ahead, develop himself as an H-boy? Or shall he try to become universal? If he tries to become universal before he has become H, all that will happen to him is that he will fall back into K. Now this is very important. When the Q-boy tries to climb above the Q-level, it's only because he just received a kick, a very hard one, from the girlfriend. Either she's run away with another boy, or she actually doesn't like this particular one, even if there's nothing out of the back. The Q-boy never lets go until he has to. And he constitutes the customer. When a pain comes in sufficiently often, from a sufficient number of signs, then he becomes enlightened by the energy of the stimulus. Now when we say enlightened, we mean that light gets into him and he becomes lighter, less gross. Remember, we're overcoming inertias. There is a cue inertia. If we add the energy of the painful stimulus, as Kierkegaard would say, let him fall in love with a girl, which gives him ideality of the first yonder, then let the girl let him down by running away with another man, and that will remove the ideality of the first order and place ideality of the second order. He still retains the idea that there is something marvellous in the universe, but he will abandon the idea that it was that particular girl. Kierkegaard thinks that that is the function. I'm not saying this, it's not my idea of the Kierkegaard says it is the function of the woman, and it's the best thing she could do for a man. First, to entrance him so that he becomes ideal in all that, and soars into the platonic field of universal affection, and then to rush away with another man. Whereupon he's left with his high idea and no gross representative. He retains his ideology. That is Kierkegaard's statement. There is something in it. How much is it we'll have to reserve for another occasion? The fact is that only the painful stimulus converts the Q-man by enlightening him with the input of energy from the painful situation, which enlightens his consciousness and takes the gross inertia off him a bit, and he then becomes irrational. First of the lowest order, he just thinks that particular girl is no good. And then he climbs very, very high and he thinks most of them are no good, and then he climbs right to the top and says, no, I'm not very good. If he gets into the head level, then he thinks they're all no good, so I might as well get a good one. Once it has been defined, they're all no good from the point of view of the Q-boy, that is to say, the male who is determined only to express that force of the absolute which comes through him to multiply, and that no individual girl likes to be simply the doorway to a non-individuated force. She, at the same level, wants to hang on to the initiating energy. Now the male element doesn't go to the female element in order to go to jail. It goes to enjoy itself. And the female does not allow this entrance other than for her end as an individual. And both of them are subjected to the absolute necessity of reproduction. When he climbs up to the K level, he discovers that all women are women. This is in principle. He doesn't at that level know that all women are men and all men are women. In other words, that the human being is a hermaphrodite. So he gets disappointed by the fact that he can't constrain one of them to be nice to him without her being nasty to him when he's being nice to another one. He can't get it to reach this universal tolerance in one leap that he feels would be a good thing if he had it. So he climbs up and through progressive pains becomes intellectualized. He then becomes a left winger. Remember, left means deprived. the right hand of God is the universal, and the nearer we go inside, the more left we are. And so we say politically that the left wing is the Q level. You see that sign on bus stops, don't you? It's the sign for those beings that will stand in a line when they see their special symbol. They do this, absolutely. The humorists at the head level who devise these symbols do so with their tongues in their teeth. London Underground means that in this metropolis you're in a hurry. You see, you can't be able to the centre without the Now, once this rationalisation level is reached, every failure is explained by a rational notion in the mind. And the whole function of this K level is to explain deficiencies. Remember, you become progressively K by being negated at the Q level. Every time a sexual attack by a man is repulsed, the energy in him that should have hit the female tongue interferes. And it goes in the head, and it goes round and round and round and explains why this failure occurred. It wasn't a failure at all. If it's a wrong girl, the wrong time, or propaganda by another fellow. It could never be that she didn't like me personally. See, that isn't a Q function. You can't think that way. Because it's a one energy, a unity energy, pointing in one direction, and it has no doubt in it at all. So when it is blocked, the energy that blocks it causes, quite mechanically, a process called thinking. And this thinking just goes round and round and round inside and explains why that failure occurred, and that it wasn't a failure at all. So the K level is full of excuses for impotence. So at your rational level, you will never find anything at all except an excuse for failure. This is why the Buddhists, who were good psychologists, said the mind, and they were referring to this K level when they used the term, is the organ of fear. All it is concerned with is the fact that it has been defeated and how to dodge it and how to explain. Now, when a sufficient number of these reasons has piled up and immobilized the being by their self-contradiction, because the essence of the intellect is that it contradicts itself, if you argue with yourself long enough, you will merely pile ideas up for and against the same thing and completely paralyze yourself. You'll be in a state of doubt and of despair. The doubt is your doubleness, the opposition of the ideas. The disparity is between what you want to do and what you can do. When you are then completely blocked, the usual thing to do, of course, is go into a mental hospital and today to receive various types of shock treatments to reduce you back to the Q level. And you are then cured. Now, the cause of this is that the heat generated by the self-contradiction and the self-image of Q as failure produces a very, very great heat in as far as I am. And when that heat is produced, flash occurs. This is the incandescence again, under this mercurial rotation of the ideas. When the flash occurs, if the fellow speaks, he would probably get locked up. Yes, he would say, I have just seen a light. And then it would be on TV and it would be explained to him that that wasn't a light at all. And they'll prove to him with a hammer that it wasn't. If, when the self-contradiction of the intellect is seen for what it is, namely self-contradiction of the intellect, and that the intellect is not all, then suddenly there becomes functionally in consciousness a new level. Let's take an example. I saw on one occasion, I was very pleased to see it, because a very tiny little man threw five policemen about when he suddenly broke down from his K level. He had been a very rational little man, but overdoing it, he had managed to contradict himself to the level of incandescence. And at that moment he spoke in Piccadilly Central, and he was immediately jumped upon, and two sat on his chest around three more came to aid, and he was tossing them about all over the place, and he was very small. But the H function appeared in him at that moment, Now, the priests don't like age functions appearing below. They love it above them because that gives them a sense of security. But they don't like it below.
Mercy. Policeman.
As you can tell by the second syllable in the word. Belong at the Q level. Now, the important thing to see is that when you burst through the intellective into the H level, you are suddenly aware of yourself as an individual will who does not have to be restrained by reason at all. If you then rush about declaring this to people, you are being un-Taoistic. The Tao says if you do not declare your aim, you cannot be said to fail. If you do declare your aim, say, I have no regard for social structures, then a lot of K-boys will start rationalizing your behavior. And they will start defining you as anti-K, that is to say, as antisocial. And if this comes to the notice of other hetmen, which it will do if the K-men have their way, the other hetmen will look at you and say, there aren't many seats up here. And suddenly you'll be thrown back into the queue level in a special little cell. So when you feel this fact of individual will coming inside you, and you know that you can do something, like make a business, or sell a refrigerator or something, over against a wicked rival and refrigerate yourself, then you have to say to yourself, I will choose. And I will choose between two ideas. One is I will sell refrigerators for my sake, and that will put you on the black magic side. And the other is I will sell refrigerators for a universal sake. And you can actually sell refrigerators for a universal sake. Can be done if you bother to identify with the universal. It has already invented the refrigerators to try to keep the Q level a bit cooler. Now, it's a very simple thing. We said that we won't use the word lack mean deficient of the universal, but we will use it of the H, K, and Q level. When you're at the H level, and this is Bert's special question, how do you know what to do when presented with alternatives? The answer is you always say to yourself, I could do this for myself, and I could do it for the universal. If I see the universal purpose behind it, I will not get hit at the individual level for it. But if I see only the individual level, the egotistic level, for doing it, I must get hit. So we place the two ideas not on the same level, but one above the other. We'll have the E level up there, and we'll have the H level there, below it. And your choice is whether you're going to go up to the universal or down to the individual. Every time you make a decision in favour of yourself as an individual, which means you have conceptualized yourself as an individual power, will, over against other individuals, then you will be in trouble. Because at the individual level, there is this cannonball mechanics of individuated forms. And you start selling things for that purpose. You have tuned yourself to the universe. You will then begin to transform. No reason at all why you shouldn't for the time place your H with the bar, the crossbar, right on the borderline, so that you can see the universal up there and make your individual application down below. The universal is the authority for everything that appears within it. Those who see the universal become aware of it, and the universal will pass through the information from the absolute about the new design of refrigerators for next year. But if the individual stretches himself as a headman over against others and fights for himself, then he cannot get the information about next year's design. So in terms of efficiency only, it is better to be universal rather than individual. Let's just revert to the semantic a moment. If we say that production of change in conformity with the will is the meaning of magic, we can be a little more precise and say that some magicians don't know they're magicians. They're functioning blindly. They are wills, and changes are being produced. But they are not reflective, and they don't really know what they're doing. And consequently, they are not efficient magicians at all. They are genuine, lacking magic. That is what happens at the Q level. At the K level, you find a terrific amount of literature read about magic. Because the K level is the intellectual level that feels its deficiency in power. So it's at the intellectual level that we find this profound interest in magic of the lower kind, black man, and magic of the upper kind, the headman level. The fact that this great mass of left-wingers, intellectuals, are interested in power, only the measure of their lack of it. So, inside any individual, if it's found that there is a tendency, on seeing a book called Black Magic, How to Do It, to grab it and rush off into a corner and start reading it, know immediately that that impulse is necessarily deficient. Because it actually thinks there's something outside itself that could give it the information it needs to make those magical changes. There's a colossal amount of literature published in America on scientific prayer, on magical prayer, and so on. It is sold to the K level. If the cover is lurid enough, it's sold to the lower K level, where the legs just go into the Q level. If the cover is abstract enough, it goes a bit higher up in the K level. And the head level doesn't bother about such literature, because he knows that he is a will, and that everything he does by will. But the top level Heyman is aware that there is a universal, and that there must be conformity of the individual will to the universal will if there is to be efficiency. So we find, I don't know whether you've read that horrible book, Gangrene, that was banned, seized by the French police, about the Algerian atrocities. The introduction by Peter Berenson is very good, because he doesn't argue sentimentally against tortures. He argues on the ground of efficiency. He says if you torture men, you make the men who are being tortured morally your superior, and they feel superior, and then they won't tell you what you want to know. So he has not sentimental but an efficient reason for being against torture. If you find a book and read it, particularly the introduction, you will enjoy that part of it. It's also about police practice, both British and French. It could be applied to all countries. When we climb up then to the K level, we find rationalizing about magic, but we don't get any performance until at the H level, the headman acts by will. But he's not so much concerned with rituals and doing certainly 1 o'clock, because those things in general belong in the K level. Now they can be used as a support even by a headman, but he never falls into believing that they are efficacious on their own. So if he draws a circle on the, he knows it's because he has drawn it. So if we find Montgomery with a photograph of Rommel in his tent in Africa, and he's studying that face and looking at the signs of character and trying to read Rommel's character, he doesn't believe that Rommel's character is in the photograph and that the photograph is magical. He believes that if he focuses on that photograph and thinks about Rommel and feels about Rommel, something about Rommel will get into him, because he knows there is a field far. And he demonstrates his superiority and efficiency in that way. So the individual magician fighting his own cause is the black magician. And there are various levels within the H level of the individual black magician on the left-hand path.
That means it's not universal, it's individual, for individual ends. But those headmen who stick their horns over the border into the universal level realize that the biggest magic won't work if it is merely individual. It's got to be made universal. In other words, you'll find a man who wants to make a major change in the country, like Hitler. Now, he is working like a headman. He's working by will, and he believed in magic, and he had an advisor, astrologer, and so on. But he did not wish to subordinate himself to the universal. He wanted to make the evolution of the earth proceed in a definite manner with Germany as the center. Now, because of certain laws to do with the precipitation of the earth from the very beginning, Germany cannot be such a center. He should have gone to England to be such a center. But he didn't go there because he was too far. He went from Austria to Germany. That was a miscalculation. He knew that certain facts of geopolitics were against it. But he didn't like what was against it, because it was against his individual will. So he cut off all the geopolitical facts that didn't subserve his thousand-year Reich. And in the act of suppressing them, of cutting them off from his consciousness, he became unaware of essential data, and thereby became inefficient. Now, when we climb up to this level of realizing there is a universal scheme, and that if we want the universal efficiency, we will have to find out what that scheme is, and then agree with it in the same way that the universal agrees with the absolute, then we can say we cannot fail. Now, you notice that Montgomery was very Taoistic, because he said, "I will not fight until I am certain that I will win." He didn't fight when the other people were ready to fight. He just waited and waited and waited for the critical moment. And so some people thought almost he wasn't a good militarist, because he just didn't fight all the time. That's so regardless. He waited. You remember in War and Peace, the waiting game that the Russians played and defeated Nap. You may remember the arguments there, that this isn't militarism, this isn't fighting, this is waiting. Well, the universal strategist who defeated Napoleon, tapping his fingers on the table, saying, "Patience and time, patience and time." Patience meant to say that there is an essence, which is in every point situation crossed. And the essence of that fact, that put, is patience. In each moment, something can be done, essentially, and nothing else. To do that thing in that moment is to be efficient and to be immediate. But to try to do something else is to disregard time. Because patience is that as put. That's the same as foot. Put your foot down. And each time you put your foot on a gross fact, and you traverse space from moment to moment to concrete situations, and in each situation there is an essential thing which can be done, and you put your foot on it, and that's patience. Whereas impatience is to make a long leg like that, which goes right over the edge of the precipice. And then when you put it down, it goes down. When we are considering this fact, if we ally ourselves with the universal, and we examine it very carefully, we will find that there are certain things that cannot be done. 4 years ago, I received a letter asking me to reply to it immediately. I didn't reply. This week, I replied to it. Now, the person receiving it will be surprised. But it was premature to reply there. And if I had replied, I would have been in trouble, because it came from a gentleman of the K level who is in jail for political activities in Germany. Now, I don't agree with his political activities, and I don't agree with his time consciousness, because I don't agree at all with what he calls the essential process. He says that revolution by application of force is the only way of overthrowing the headmen. The fact is, they can only be overthrown from above. Anybody who starts a revolution at the Q level will get a black eye. If you start one at the K level, you'll get a row in the office. If you start one at the head level, you will probably be chased out to Whitehall. And if you try to start one at the universal level, you'll suddenly find yourself roped in and used as part of the merry-go-round. What we have to do is realize this. When Christ says, what the Father does, the absolute, I, the magnificent self, do also. And the Father gives without measure, that is without counting. This is to do with this divine. And it comes in without measure because it is continuous. Absolute reality is not made of parts, and therefore there is no counting in it. And therefore it gives itself without measure. But as soon as this rotation is considered and identified with, counting begins where that absolute is considered to be internal to that rotation. So the rotation is the ground of the count. When it comes inside now, the universal doesn't count it. But the absolute coming within the sphere reverberates within the sphere, and those reverberations within it cut it into minute portions, which are dominions, which are houses, and ultimately places. Pylois, his little spiritual dwellings, of which Christ says, every man has his own place, he goes to it, and his work follows. The absolute energy goes in, into the universal, is differentiated within the universal, only actually, there's no discrete particle, absolutely separated. There are merely vibrations of the absolute, which, when identified with, appear to be discrete. And so, there are different speeds, relatively, from the perimeter, the E level, up to the H level, and change of frequency through the H level, change of frequency through the K level, change of frequency to the Q level. Each frequency getting slower, longer way, duller, more gross, more inertic, more ignorant. I'm going to turn now to a very learned paper by Mr. Bly here, which is very, very good. He doesn't call it a question because it is a series of comments on ideas of the absolute. And they're very well thought out, so we'll discuss them a little. He says, the idea of impulses as centers of circles, the number of which extends to infinity, leads us into contradiction. Because we cannot have an infinite number. Now, an infinite number, by the use of the indefinite article, an infinite number, is one infinite number. The contradiction here is not in the idea of the impulses as centers of circles. It is in the use of the expression, we, finite beings, cannot have, finitely possess, an infinite, that is non-finite, number. When we're formulating ideas in this manner, we have to be tremendously careful. Let's take out those disqualifying words. The idea of impulses as centers of circles, the number of which extends to infinity, leads into contradiction. I've left us out of it. We're not contradiction. Leads into contradiction. Contradiction means contra-same. There is some opposition. And of course there is. If we postulate a lot of circles and we cover infinite space with them, we have introduced contradiction. The contradiction is the same, the diction of each one of these points, against the others. It is not more than that. The contradiction is always an actual contradiction of motions from centers. If we leave out we and so on and possess and we have, then the idea reduces to this fact that the consideration of centers of impulse leads to contradiction. It's the real substance of that particular idea.
When you formulate an idea like this, it is evidence of a large amount of work at the K level, which is leading, at the moment you see the paradox, to the H level. Now remember, the paradox is beyond this K level. The H man is essentially paradoxical. A certain very large religious organization bases itself on Aristotelian logic. We will translate Aristotle as meaning death to the Aristotles. And because the logic of Aristotle is not paradoxical, it says A equals A and not A is not A, that is not paradoxical at all. They cannot handle a paradoxical situation. At the K level, the situation is always A not A. The thing is either A or not A. But every being itself is and is not, because it is becoming. And becoming is a word that resolves the difference between being and non-being. What are we? We are becoming. We are not babies and we are not yet old men. We are becoming between babies and old men. So we cannot say either I am a baby or not, or I am an old man or not, in spite of the difference. We can only say, I am becoming. But becoming means being non-being, simultaneously. So the fact of my being becoming is already paradoxical, which places it above the K-level. So to climb into initiative power, we have to become paradoxical. We must get over this reasoned statement saying, well, you can't do that there here, because A is A and not A is not A. This kind of statement has been used by people of the Aristotelian persuasion very often. A long time ago in the Renaissance, a man looked through a telescope he just made and rushed off and said, I have seen spots on the sun. And a learned divine picked up a copy of Aristotle's works and said, I'm sorry, you're mistaken, Aristotle doesn't mention them. Now, that kind of blockage of truth must arise from a non-paradoxical system. A non-paradoxical system is presenting one side of a coin and denying that the other side of the coin has anything to do with the coin. So it's all heads all the way through. I remember once meeting a very fun little fellow who said that he had split a pound note with a razor blade and passed them. I said, but how did you manage to pass them when they were only printed on one side? And he hadn't thought of it. So he said, well, as a matter of fact, the ink soaks through from both sides, and if you cut very carefully, you've got 2 pound notes printed on both sides. He hadn't noticed the mechanical deficiency of the printing method. Now, the second one here says, these circles would also mean that counting would be possible in the absolute, which is also contradictory. Now again, this is a very, very good perception. This fact of prediction. Remember when we look at the sea flat, we cannot count the sea. But if the wind blows on it and makes ripples, we can count the ripples. We're still not counting the sea, we're counting the ripples. When we think about the infinite, by definition of the infinite, it is not thin. And consequently, it cannot be counted. But there's nothing at all against us counting ripple, crests, or troughs within an infinite motion. We can't help it, no. If we can't help it, there's nothing against it. As the Bhagavad Gita says, why grieve for the inevitable? Three, the absolute is non-dual and therefore not particular. Therefore counting is impossible. This again is answered by this fact. We can count crests and troughs of motions without in fact being able to count absolute motion. Fourth one, since one circle is surrounded by 6 others, the absolute would exist. Again, this is a paradox. All the existence, which means existere out of 6, runs right through, but when we are talking about the circles, we are not talking about the absolute. This frame of reference. We're talking about the actualizing circles. So the absolute does not exist, but it's the very ground of existence. Philosophers have dreadful difficulty with respect to the absolute, because if they use the word exist of it, the scientists become very annoyed and prove that it can't. Whereas it is only action that exists.
Please drive Walgrave Road. Again, a petty boy meeting up another boy time.
If we try to think of these circles as non-rotating, we are confused by those that are rotations. This is actually a statement about a psychological difficulty of thinking about circles non-rotating and others rotating. Remember that in fact the circle doesn't rotate at all. If you put your mind on it, it will tend to go round it. And if you're not careful, it will go round a lot of them. Because the psyche gets bored, literally. It bores hold of itself by going over and over the same stimulus. It loses interest, and therefore it skips off onto another circle. Now, there are a lot more of these ideas, which are very well thought out, but careful examination of them will illustrate that the removal of a certain word here and there will, in fact, resolve the problem by making a paradoxical statement, including the two horns of the dilemma. This is a good one here. The absolute before creation is still and waiting, a state of no motion. An act of will or spontaneity creates the universe. Now, remember what we said about the word static. We cannot use the word static of the absolute, and we cannot use the word still of the absolute, because still and static are derived from sense percepts of finite. And they're only relative. If a motion goes round and round and round, it constitutes, relative to another one, the distance between which does not change, a still zone. And that stillness has nothing to do with the absolute. The absolute is not still. Still refers necessarily to this ST function. As soon as you get STL, you know that you are dealing with something tied up and fixed. And the absolute itself is the would you like to do a little exercise on those and look through them, and I'll look through them, there's a lot of them here, and we will compare notes about the results of the examination, shall we, on another occasion. So I just want to look at the question here, but it's rather important. What time? An individual man is understood as spirit investing itself with a vehicle of experience, which vehicle has engrammed on it the experience of his ancestors. An individual who appears to be stressed on certain functions, an individual also appears to be stressed on certain functions, and he can be referred to as a type. Can we discuss the type activity in relation to his other manifestations and possibilities, as it is observed that this activity is the strongest enemy, the least easily observed, only in oneself, and therefore the most difficult to work against? Can type be equated with Gurdjieff's idea of essence? We'll dismiss the last part immediately. Type cannot be equated with Gurdjieff's idea of essence, because type here is form, and as defined, is the form of an individual man. And here, far, soft, hard. We must assert both of a pair of opposites to the absolute, and therefore, when we are considering differentiating factors, namely individuation factors, we are not talking about the absolute, and therefore we're not actually talking about spirit, which is the absolute. We're talking about vehicles of spirit. Now, each vehicle, we'll say each human vehicle for this purpose, has engrammed on it the experiences of his ancestors. This we know because butterflies beget butterflies and humans beget humans. They form in the egg expresses itself, and thereby we know the continuity that we mean by heredity. An individual who appears to be stressed on certain functions can be referred to as a type. Now, by type, obviously, we're talking about a concept which is very closely related to topos, place. Now, when Christ says, every man has his own place and goes in, he's saying that there is a topos, a place, and that the form in that place is typical. In other words, every place in our diagram of the infinite impulsation is peculiarly itself, and the vibrations initiated in that place are the characterizing or individuating factors which separate it from the others. All separation is only actual, and is an actualizing of individuating or formal factors. Form is action. And if you act in A manner, then you will be differentiated from a being acting in B manner. So, now, this type activity is the strongest enemy. We can see that it must be so immediately. As soon as we consider that type activity is the activity of the place. Supposing we take a human being, we trace him back, and we discover that he came from an egg. And that egg was resident in a body, maybe the mother, and was impregnated by another one from a man, and at least two were bodies. Now, all bodies occupy spaces and demark spaces. Each body is a form in a place. It's really a function of a place. So that to be born and to be carried is to be carried in a place, a topos. And all the places through which that being goes are conditioning factors on the form born. So, in the same way, we are carried in our mothers, we are carried on earth, not on Saturn or Venus, on earth. And the earth has a certain distance from the sun, a certain orbit, a certain length of year, and exposes all the forms on the earth to certain cosmic forces. Again, the earth is in a place, and there are type bands on the earth. Thus, the life on the equator is typified by its topical or place values. Its form value and its place value can be equated. So, a person born in Liverpool is not born in Wigan or Rio de Janeiro or something. Wherever it is born, it is subjected to definite forces which intersect at that place. So every place has its own formal vibration, and a being in that place is subjected to it, retains the memory of that to which it has been subjected, and therefore becomes progressively characterized by the places in which it is resident. Now it's obvious, certainly, to be interior to a being is very much to be placed. We are placed on the earth, in the solar system. The solar system is in a vastly larger system, and we are conditioned by these forces, and the more so, the less we understand them. This fact of the big universal place has conditioned all the subspaces within it. There is no escape from that without the recognition of what it means to be placed, to be in a topos and to be typis, to be formed by place. If we are aware of this fact, we can see what it means that place is the strongest enemy. Type is the strongest enemy. The form in a given place is the enemy. You will notice that it's a characteristic delivery in every town in the country. And in every country in the world, there's a characteristic speech, a characteristic vocabulary, and the vocabulary conditions the people who use it, conditions their thoughts. You know that in some of the primitive languages, they have no vocabulary for technical subjects that we find in the West, and therefore they cannot begin to think about the kind of problems the that are dealt with by the Western mind. So, when we are exposed to a place, we're exposed to a variety of influences, social, and so on, particularly by vocabulary influences from tradition, and those things fill the mind with form, so the form is just a measure of the place. This is the TP function. Again, we said the TT put the patient's senses, and the T would be, it's the same thing. You put, that's the foot, foundation, and what you put down is the place. And wherever you put your foot, you will be conditioned by it. This is why Christ says, when a man marries a woman, they shall become one flesh. Not they'll be fond of each other. They shall become one flesh. Because when he puts his energies into that place, and you recognize the root again, TPP here. In fact, he is introducing spatially derived determinants into this other being, and receiving such determinants into himself. So that St. Paul says, if you knew what you received when you were giving in that relation, you would be careful about the kind of relation into which you enter. Because you are bound to receive. One fellow, about a year ago it will be, roughly, was rather shocked to discover that all his previous girlfriends were engrammed on his brain, and that he had a lot of mannerisms, and even his chemistry had changed. And when it was demonstrated to him, he was still carrying about with him what he had acquired from these girls. He was horrified, because he had acquired, this was a horrifying thing to him, the vocabularies of their boyfriends. Now the cue motive in him didn't like it. In talking to these various girls and being enamored of them for long enough, he had been conditioned by the boys who had already conditioned the girls. So he was not, in effect, simply acting on the girl and receiving nothing. He was being imposed on by boys as well as imposing on the girl, and this he didn't like. He thought he would give it up. Now, the enemy, of course, the strongest enemy, is the most difficult to work against. How are we going to work against this fact that topos, place, and type, form, are inextricably related? The answer is by non-identification with form, with place. A fellow who's born in the Whitechapel Road, and who worries about it, identified with it, will have trouble about certain concepts related to it. Now, if he wants to break out of that type behaviour, he must break out of the memory of the place. Now, he can only do this by studying more places. He can't eliminate Whitechapel from himself. Such a place is hard to eliminate. So, the only thing to do with it is to discover the environment, to do a bit of local history around it, and in so doing to extend the concept. Gradually you can cover London, and then you can cover England, and eventually cover the world. The only way you can escape the domination of one place is by the extension of that attention beyond the limits of the conditioning place, until you identify not with the place in which you were born, brought up, dragged up, pushed up, or whatever, but you're going to go out beyond the little local earth setting, beyond the solar system, beyond the sidereal system, and finally to realize that the universe itself is a precipitate of the absolute, and that you can identify with the universal, and that will contain all these other places. And you will then have become of universal form in having become aware of universal place. Then when you remember that the universe is a precipitate of the absolute, you can then abandon the identification with the universal and identify with the absolute. The universal won't disappear on that account. And emotions will still be there with all the other spheres, but now their internal relations will be comprehended simultaneously. So we can admit that type is a very great enemy, but type is like place, reducible to another word that everybody thinks is too simple, inertia. The real enemy is inertia and nothing else. Inertia means in work, affirmation. See? The amount of work or energy involved, there's the work, the egg. If you put a G there, you'll recognize the egg. If you put a K there, you'll recognize the intellectual attitude to work. It is irksome. Ya is affirmation. See? Work in. Every finite is simply an energy working in and keeping itself in. That's the Saturnine value again. Saturn is dominating Jupiter where there is inertia. Now, inertia has a definite value. The absolute posits primary inertia, matter, the matrix of all things, cues it and emerges through it again. In reflexive self-conscious being. If instead of worrying about type and place, we turn them all into the fact of work, we can still remember that place is form and form is place, and that you have never seen a place that wasn't characterized by form, and you've never seen a form that wasn't in a place, and that what you think or feel about forms is largely conditioned by their spatial relations with other forms. So we make the equation here that all problems, whatever, are problems of inertia. And the way to conquer that is, as we said, transcending space, place, transcending form. That wasn't a deliberate mistake. Transcending place, we can't transcend space. Transcending place is the same thing as breaking inertias of identification. Remember, all that is can never cease to be. But what we hold as central to our consciousness determines. Where the treasure is, there is the heart also. The heart is the center. And it is that universal, you see the H-E, heart, which is a little taller again. And the center is that hole that cannot be filled by the motion. There is the art, the tor, and in the middle is the head, which is the spirit. And that is the heart. Where the heart is, there is the treasure. And the treasure is the Torah Shor. It implies that your security is in it. If you then place as central to your consciousness any level, Q, K, H, or whatever it is, or any particular you automatically make it a heart. And when you make it into a heart, energies flow to it and away from it, just like the blood goes to and from the heart. The whole of your life is then conditioned by that concept with which you have identified. So to escape all these types, these places, these inertias, is the same thing as continuously practicing non-identification. In the Bhagavad Gita it says, worship is continual remembrance. Now to remember is to make again a member. We want to become again a member of the universal to gain our identification with the absolute. We must make ourselves a member of the universal. Because only by becoming universal can the individual level be transcended. And only when the universal has been gained can we do an absolute will.